Coming up is the news.
Headlines this hour. Iran's top negotiator arrives in the Qatari capital for indirect talks with the United States on the removal of anti-Tehran sanctions. Britain's criminal lawyers stage a walkout over low wages and insufficient government funding amid the country's dire economic crisis and the soaring cost of living. And 46 people are found dead inside of a truck in Texas in one of the most deadly incidents of human smuggling along the U.S.-Mexico border. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's top negotiator has arrived in the Qatari capital, Doha, to hold indirect talks with the U.S. on the revival of the 2015 deal, also known as the JCPOA. That is according to the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman. Nasser Kanani says that the trip is made within the framework of agreements reached during the recent visit to Tehran by the JCPOA Joint Commission Coordinator Joseph Borrell. Iran says that it was informed by Borrell that the U.S. has agreed to fulfill all of its obligations under the JCPOA and ensure Iran's economic benefits. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian also says the new round of talks could yield a final agreement if the U.S. and the three EU parties to the deal adopt a realistic approach. The 2015 deal was left in tatters after the former U.S. administration unilaterally abandoned it in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran. Talks to revive the JCPOA began in the Austrian capital in April of last year between Iran and the remaining signatories to the accord. The U.S. indirectly participated in the Vienna talks. After several rounds, the talks were stalled in March of this year over what Iran called the U.S. failure to make the necessary decisions. International affairs expert Zamir Ahmad Awan believes the United States is somehow stuck in a kind of paradoxical situation that it has created in its policy towards Iran.
I am not sure, but it seems that Americans are flexible now. They have realized the ground situation. And if they will not satisfy Iran's demand, the deal will not happen. Definitely, on the other hand, they want to keep Iran as a terror or threat to the oil-rich Middle Eastern country to sell their weapons. But on the other hand, they also wanted to reach a deal with Iran. They cannot afford enmity with Iran for indefinite time. They are compelled by the geopolitics that they need more friends, less enemies. And in this background, I believe the Americans have to show some flexibility.
Iran says Greece has released an Iranian-flagged oil tanker that it seized 2 months ago under U.S. pressure. According to the Ports and Maritime Organization, the tanker is set to load the oil cargo, which had been illegally transferred to a U.S. chartered vessel. Earlier this month, a court in Greece ruled that the cargo must be returned to its owner, overturning an earlier ruling that allowed the U.S. confiscation of part of the shipment. At the time, Iran described the seizure of the oil cargo as an act of piracy and in violation of international law. Greek authorities claim they seized the ship due to European Union sanctions. Palestinian movement Hamas making a plea for international action to end Israeli violations in the occupied Al-Quds. Hamas says countries and international organizations have a responsibility to put an end to the regime's crimes, illegal settlement activity, and the Judaization of Islamic and Christian holy sites. The resistance movement is urging Muslim nations to support the Palestinian fight for their land and sanctities, especially the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The movement is also warning Israel that Al-Quds remains an inseparable part of Palestine and that all attempts to change the city's identity will fail. Israel occupied Al-Quds 55 years ago in a move never recognized by the international community. Over the past months, the regime has intensified its attacks on worshippers in and around the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Israeli settlers also regularly transgress into the holy Muslim compound. The World Food Program says it is suspending humanitarian aid to Yemen The international body says it is halting the shipments due to a lack of funding and disruptions in food supplies rooted in the war in Ukraine. Dr. Latif Al-Washali has more from Sana'a.
After years of war and blockade on Yemen, and just as hopes were being raised that the humanitarian situation will improve thanks to the UN brokered truce, the World Food Programme has announced that it is suspending humanitarian work in the country since the beginning of June. The body says it is short on funding and that obstacles to food supply due to war in Ukraine are making things worse.
There is no doubt that the decision of the World Food Programme to suspend its activities in Yemen is catastrophic and surprising. The World Food Programme announced earlier this year that it will be cutting off on humanitarian aid for Yemen due to lack of funding. The suspension of humanitarian activities is a totally different story and has major repercussions, as Yemen is facing what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Unfortunately, the UN and its food assistance programme link humanitarian aid to political and military issues.
The program now says that the Yemen humanitarian response plan for 2022 is 74% underfunded, which means the program requires $1.5 billion in funding.
What the media reported, that the World Food Program will suspend its activities in Yemen, will lead to a humanitarian catastrophe with unimaginable consequences. We hold the United Nations fully responsible for the repercussions of halting humanitarian aid, as Yemen is in a phase of famine.
Saudi Arabia began its war on Yemen in March 2015 and has imposed a siege on the country ever since. The war has killed tens of thousands of civilians and pushed the war-torn country to the brink of famine, where almost 80% of the population depends on humanitarian aid to survive.
After all the hard work put into reaching the current truce and extending it, suspension of humanitarian aid could also undermine the political process. The United Nations should now double its efforts and change its strategies to help Yemenis in dire need of aid. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. In the UK, strikes over low wages have spread to the legal profession. British criminal lawyers have staged a walkout in London to protest against government funding and dwindling earnings. According to the Criminal Bar Association, barristers voted for industrial action earlier this month. More than 80% of its members backed walkouts. On Monday, several hundred barristers gathered outside of the Central Criminal Court. They have refused to take on new cases or cover cases for colleagues, which have overrun. Protesting lawmakers say that their real earnings have dropped around 30% since 2006. They also say that many junior barristers have left their jobs due to low income. The Criminal Bar Association has urged the government to sit down with barristers for negotiation.
This must come to an end, and it will, if this government is prepared to sit down with us and negotiate. We cannot continue to work like this.
The CBA also said the walkout is aimed at preventing the collapse of the criminal justice system, which is already mired in a crisis. It said the justice system has long been suffering from a shortage of lawyers. The British government has reacted to the strike, saying the walkouts are regrettable. The lawyer strikes comes hot on the heels of an industrial action by some 40,000 British railway workers. Our correspondent Saeed Purezo joins us from London to give us the latest on this. Rodney Shakespeare, professor of binary economics, also joins us from London for an analysis. Welcome to you both. Saeed Purezo, first over to you. We're looking at these barristers in the justice system of the UK. So this is, I'm guessing, very important in terms of the strike. Tell us why they've decided to do this at this point, and the depth of how this strike is going to affect the justice system and as we just read in the news, or I just read in the news, that is there a possibility of the justice system breaking down because of this?
It's very difficult to predict that, but what is clear is that this is part of what is referred to as the UK summer of unrest, a series of protests that are going to be staged and have been staged by people in different sectors. So we have seen over the past couple of weeks protests staged by railway workers, the underground workers, causing massive disruptions to the transportation system, followed now by these barristers, people in the criminal justice system, to be followed in the coming weeks and months by people in other industrial sectors, such as teachers, as well as nurses, people working for the NHS, the National Health Service. The reason for all of this, it should be sought out. Soaring cost of living, or the cost of living crisis in this country. Wages are not going up in tandem with the rising rate of inflation, and so these people are out on the streets demanding a pay rise, barristers included. There are, as we all heard yesterday, and all of the media, they're underpaid and they cannot really pay for their daily expenses. And you're looking at an inflation rate that has already gone up to a little over 9%, expected to exceed 10% in the coming months, of course, spread unevenly among the rich and poor. The rich, for example, experiencing a little over 8% of inflation, whereas the poor are experiencing just under 11% of it already, and that's only June. Things are going to get much worse come October. Already, for example, you're looking at fully employed nurses having to rely on food banks to make ends meet, to be able to put food on their table. And also, you're looking at people in other parts of the economy having to handle their expenses on a monthly basis. You're looking at prices, for example, increasing across the board. The reason, of course, should be sought in a few things. For example, Brexit is a major contributor. The disruptions to supplies as a result of the UK leaving the European Union. Add to that the post-pandemic economy, the global market forces that are inevitable, obviously. But and then the ongoing military conflict in Ukraine that has sent food prices up. Ukraine and Russia being major producers of grains. Add to that, for example, the decision to ban grains by India to protect national supplies. All of those things have contributed to the growing rise in the cost of living here in the UK. Of course, other EU economies are dealing with the same thing, and globally as well. So as to why, again, these solicitors, barristers rather, are out there up in arms asking for their pays, their wages to be increased, should be sought in the cost mm-hmm. of.
Okay, Rodney Shakespeare, just while Syed was talking there, I figure I'd brush up on my knowledge of what the latest inflation rate is for the UK, and I'm looking at not the 9%, but rather what Bloomberg says, closing in on the double-digit inflation. Obviously, people there in the UK, especially government employees, are concerned. Can the government handle this? And, you know, you're looking at an influx that is spreading across sectors in terms of the types of demands that they have.
11%. But if you are poor, that's 11% of just the things that you have to have, like food. And no one is now believing 11%, 15 is much more likely. But the key point about the barristers going on strike is that they are the professional middle classes going on strike. And whenever you have a really serious political struggles, they never get anywhere until the elements of the middle classes get involved. And that is now going on, not just in the UK, but elsewhere. Right the way around the world, the stresses are building. A good example is a meeting of countries in North and South America, where five countries refused to attend because three had been banned. In other words, they were defying America. And that sort of standing up at the same time as Colombia, a right-wing country, changes and goes left. These are signs that the inflation and the stresses is going right the way around the world. And they, at the moment, they're making it worse. There are some obvious things to do. but they are bullheaded. They are on a train which is going forward. They have no means of stopping themselves. They go forward and they make the situation worse.
All right, very well. We'll leave it there. Thank you very much for that. That's Roddy Shakespeare, professor of binary economics from London, and also from London. Thank you very much for your good points there. Saeed Pourreza, who spoke to us, also from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in. A remote area in Texas, an abandoned truck, and stacks of dead bodies. That is the grim picture from one of the deadliest cases of human smuggling along the U.S.-Mexico border. U.S. authorities have found the bodies of 46 undocumented migrants in a semi-trailer near the rail track in San Antonio. 16 people, including four minors, were still alive. They are currently being treated for heat strokes and exhaustion. So far, three people are in police custody. The U.S. border with Mexico has seen an influx of migrants over the past months. Many of them have returned under a controversial policy that former President Donald Trump introduced. Incumbent Joe Biden has faced a lot of criticism from fellow Democrats for failing to reverse the restrictions, but Republicans blast his open border policy. And that is it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Insight.
Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the legality of the unilateral coercive measures imposed on Iran by the U.S. and the West in a conversation with UN Special Rapporteur Professor Alena Duhan. But first, this brief analysis.
The appointment of Professor Alena Duhan as UN Special Rapporteur examining the effects of unilateral coercive measures on human rights represents a significant victory for the nations of the non-aligned movement within the context of international law and the politics of the United Nations. Traditionally, the US and its Western allies have abused the United Nations, particularly the UN Human Rights Council and the International Court, as tools to further their political and strategic goals in the international arena, with the facade of international law and human rights covering up brutal power politics. In this game, the accused always seem to be countries, governments, and individuals who oppose US policies and strategies, and the world never sees Western governments or elites who have committed war crimes and mass killings. People such as George Bush, Dick Cheney, or Tony Blair, or those who killed thousands of innocent civilians in drone strikes such as Barack Obama, being investigated or prosecuted by these international legal organizations. The United States has gotten used to abusing unilateral economic sanctions as a policy tool whenever it does not know what else to do, because it has no risk domestically and is a convenient platform for US politicians to grandstand for their Zionist campaign donors. Nobody seems to care about the devastating effects that these sanctions have had on ordinary people. With the appointment of Professor Duhan as Special Rapporteur, the effects of these unilateral sanctions and measures are being examined within the context of the UN Human Rights Council. And this can help global public opinion to examine all sides of the issue based on the reports of a party other than the two countries involved. This might not change the sadistic sanctions imposed by the United States and its vessels. But it does mean that the most important part of the story, namely the facts about the devastating effects that these sanctions have on everyday people in Iran and other countries they are imposed on, will be brought to light by a third party. In a world governed by the law of the jungle, this will not replace Iran and other countries using the many tools of their national power to fight US crimes and power projection. But it does change the factual context within which these debates are conducted, and it might move some countries and societies who claim to follow international law and human rights to think twice before blindly following whatever the United States orders them to do.
Good afternoon, Professor Duhan. Thank you for joining us on Insight. We were scheduled to do the interview while you were in Tehran. Of course, you were very busy. And so, unfortunately, we were not able to conduct this conversation in person. But this is also good. You are now back home, and you are rested, and we are able to have a nice, in-depth discussion about your trip to Iran and what you were trying to accomplish here. So, in a way, Professor, it seems to me that this is even crueler than you know, if you're going to have unilateral sanctions, fine, you have it. So, this seems to be even a crueler way of dealing with this issue. You have certain things which are technically exempt from these vast array of sanctions that are against Iran, as they should be because of medical and basic human needs. And yet we see there's threats. There's an atmosphere, an environment of threats, of fear that is spread to other countries, particularly European countries. That if a company whose job, whose main function is to sell medicine to countries that need it, and Iran has the money to buy it, Iran is not asking them to give it to for free. Even that country is scared of having one document, one transfer of money that it received from Iran, because then the U.S. could possibly sanction it in its other businesses. And then adding to that, as you mentioned, so even if that's capable of coming, being able to deliver it, this idea of sanctioning the banking system. And here I want to maybe move to discussing the idea of sanctioning a country's central bank, because as far as I remember, this is unique. We've never had this. If we were going to compare, you know, this economic war to a real war, you could say maybe this was this is the atomic bomb of economic sanctions, because so much of what a country does is done through its central bank. So if you could please maybe talk a little bit about this issue of the idea of sanctioning the central bank of Iran and how this has affected, devastated, as you mentioned in your preliminary report, the situation of human rights in Iran.
First of all, it's necessary to say that when we are speaking about the banking system, we are speaking about two elements. The first element is freezing money, so freezing assets of central banks of a country abroad. Correct. And here, Iran is not unique. And secondly, we are speaking about cutting off the banks of a country from the international banking system.
Correct.
As concerned the first part, unfortunately, this tendency is expanding today, and this tendency clearly goes counter international standards of the immunities of property of state. There is a convention on the property, judicial immunity of state property, which clearly says that assets of central banks are assets for the use of the state, and the state is exercises its supreme powers and its sovereign powers, including guaranteeing the well-being of population on the territory via having the possibility to use these assets.
Professor, excuse me, I just want to just explain for our audience. So it is a matter, a settled matter of international law, of international relations, that you cannot have a functioning international system if countries are not capable of using their own resources and assets in other areas of the world. That this is a red line, that countries do not seize and freeze the assets, the sovereign assets of other countries, otherwise the whole system would fall apart.
I will mention that from the point of customary international law, mm-hmm. it refers to the assets of central banks.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I'm not speaking about the assets of commercial banks in specific situation. I'm only talking about the state assets of central banks being frozen abroad. And for example, recently, me together with some other mandate holders, we have forwarded a communication to the United States as concern the issue of the freezing assets of Afghanistan Central Bank.
Exactly.
Because due to the humanitarian situation in Afghanistan, the possibility to use this money to provide the basic human needs for these people is very important.
Exactly.
So from the point of international law, freezing these assets is illegal. State shall be able to use it. When coming to the second part, cutting off a state from the international financial system, we come to another package of international legal norms which are affected. Primarily, in contemporary system of international relations and international financial transactions, each of us is very much dependent on the possibility to be able to communicate, to use money, and to tell the truth, I can hardly imagine a sphere of work or a sphere of academic cooperation or private life, mm-hmm. which is not affected by that. So in reality, cutting off the possibility to use banking system is affecting human rights of every single individual, not in the territory of the country which is cut off the banking system, but of other individuals as well, of individuals abroad, and plus of foreigners on the territory of the country.
Correct. You mentioned that you have to bring cash to Iran to pay for things.
So in reality, every foreigner who is coming, not only me, every foreigner who is coming to Iran can't use their international banking cards. During my previous country visits, like to Qatar, to Zimbabwe, and to Venezuela, I could easily pay with my banking card there, but I was not able to pay with the card in Iran. And in reality, every foreigner coming to Iran is to bring money in cash in order to pay and can't use the cards. That, as a result, is not only inconvenient for individual, but also affect the tourist area in every country, because people are feeling non-comfortable when being not able to use their banking cards. The same cards for the people living in Iran, which can't do any transactions abroad, starting from any import-export operations, so the businesses are affected enormously. Naturally, investors are not interested to come to Iran because of the impossibility or very complicated way to do financial transactions. People can't participate in cooperation. I believe one of the most flagrant elements is when Iran is not able to transfer money to pay the membership fees to international organization. That means it affects the principle of cooperation among states. The same comes to any individual and the same comes to any institution in the country. For example, to academic cooperation, to sport cooperation, to business association, to participation in international business associations, or to participate in industrial, academic, or any other sorts of conferences. If you need to pay a membership fee, you need to be able to transfer money. If you need to pay for participation in the conference, you need to be able to transfer money. The same comes to booking hotels. The same comes to buying flights, booking flights, and many other elements. Same situation comes to the undermine the possibility to exercise in the due way diplomatic relations between states, because diplomats in Iran are also facing similar problems.
Correct.
And the same international organizations face the same problems because they can't get transfers.
Professor, I want to now go a little bit more in one of the details of the report that you wrote and concerning the U.S. Here you state that you call on sanctioning states, in particular the United States, to lift all unilateral measures imposed against Iran and so on without the authorization of the UN Security Council. And you have this interesting sentence, whose use cannot be justified as retortions or countermeasures in accordance with international law. So that, and then in the next paragraph, you talk about, I urge the U.S. government to cease the state of national emergency that is not in accordance with the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. So if you could talk about a little bit the issue of the U.S. and how, in these two examples that you mentioned, their sanctions are in violation of international law.
Generally speaking, sometimes it's permissible under international law to use sanctions in the general understanding. First of all and foremost, the UN Security Council is expressly entitled by the Charter of the United Nations to decide on the use of non-military and military sanctions in the situations when the behavior of states constitutes a threat to peace, breach of peace, or an act of aggression. There was a period UN Security Council be applied to Iran. So
exactly.
The legality of these sanctions,
exactly. So there was a difference.
Was not disputed.
Correct, Professor. So there was a time, and then there was also between until 2015, and then later
now no sanctions of the UN Security Council are imposed on Iran. So not at all. When one speaks about the activity without authorization of the UN Security Council, we need to keep in mind that states are always trying to influence each other in one or another way. And some measures which are called sanctions in the media may be legal. For example, so-called retortions, when a state takes unfriendly steps to mm-hmm. another state, but these steps do not violate international law. I will give two examples. First of all, two states negotiate to conclude a trade agreement.
Yes.
And then one state decides, I'm not happy with your policy in this sphere. If you do not change the policy, we will think for a while and won't conclude an agreement right now.
Correct.
Non-concluding agreement in this situation, as far as they have no agreement by this moment, is their decision. It's very unfriendly. It demonstrates an attempt of pressure, but it doesn't violate international legal norms. So states are free to conclude agreements or decide to not to conclude an agreement. Another case may be under diplomatic law, states are free to decide whether they like every specific diplomatic agent being on their territory.
Correct.
Or not.
Correct.
And therefore, states may demonstrate its dissatisfaction with the behavior of another state via the decision to close the diplomatic office of this state, or to minimize the number of diplomatic staff. And in that case, it will be unfriendly act, demonstrate dissatisfaction, but it's legal. So states can do it. And from the point of international law, it's not sanctions, it's retortion.
Okay, so Professor, excuse me, because I want to state this a little bit more clearly for our audience. So in your legal opinion, there might be a case where we could say that the US sanctions between 2010 to 2015 might have been legal under international law because they were under I don't know the technical term, but they were under the auspices of the UN Security Council, but that the sanctions after that, after the UN sanctions on Iran were lifted, particularly those after 2018, in your legal opinion, are clearly a violation of international law. Do I understand you correctly?
Partially. When it comes to the period of 2010-2015, it's necessary to take into account that only those measures which clearly fall under authorization of the UN Security Council mm-hmm. are legal. Everything would go, or for example, measures like deciding not to conclude treaty or measures deciding to stop diplomatic relations. These are legal.
Yes.
There could also be cases of countermeasures. So basically violating international law, but in a very, very limited scope. So if you need, I can explain a little bit later in more details. But all the rest is illegal.
So even those 2010 to 2015, it was a mix. Some of them might have been legal under it, and some of them were clearly violations of international law.
Yes.
Okay. And then the 2018 ones, there is no question in your legal opinion that...
When it comes to the period after 2018, again, if there were situations of, for example, stopping diplomatic relations.
Yes, those examples that you mentioned.
Yeah, so these are legal. All the rest is not legal.
Yes,
what I want to say, if you want to just practically speaking, the vast majority of them are then illegal under international law. Okay, now, but this is a little bit different than the situation of the national emergency law that is in the U.S. that's been imposed on Iran since 1995, which is renewed every year, because this is simply just the U.S. itself deciding it's going to do this. There's no connection in any way, shape, or form with the U.N. or any international legal system. So if you could explain that also, because you clearly write that this is a violation and you ask the Americans to comply their national law with international law. If you could please explain that a little bit for us.
Situation of national emergency is pretty specific under international law. So in general, International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights recognized the possibility to exercise certain rights in the cases of national emergency.
Correct.
However, the covenant itself sets a very precise criteria when and how the state of national emergency can be exercised. And among those criteria is the explicit threat to the existence of the nation, as well as many other elements, including, for example, temporary character, for example, and announcement at the level of law. And the last one, there is a certain scope of human rights which never can be violated, right? For example, the right to life or the right to fair trial, or the prohibition of torture.
Correct.
In the situation of the United States, unfortunately, as I can see, it's not only a situation of Iran. The United States chose a strategy to announce a state of national emergency in every case as a ground to introduce unilateral sanctions against other states or against individuals of other states.
So this is this is like an abuse of a principle which is acceptable principle, that a country can decide that there is a national emergency. This is within the rights of any sovereign nation to do this, or any government to make that distinction. But what it seems that the U.S. is doing is that it's declaring any country or any nation that might be going contrary to its desires as a threat to national life in the U.S. and using this as a tool to impose these sanctions, which then have this devastating effect on human rights. Have I understood what the Americans are doing correctly?
That's not about states only as a threat. So in reality, despite recognizing the fact that every state is entitled to announce the state of national emergency under the conditions and very strictly within the conditions fixed in the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the United States is qualifying not only behavior of countries or specific events or even behavior of specific individuals as a threat to national emergency. However, the criteria of Article 4 of International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights are not observed. And it shall also be noted that when the U.S. is providing information from Universal Periodic Review to Human Rights Council, the U.S. has been repeatedly criticized for violation of Article 4. And I always refer to the violation of Article 4 and misuse of the state of national emergency in, I guess, nearly every communication I forwarded to the U.S.
Correct. So, in other words, what we see is that there is this term called lawfare. I'm sure you're familiar with it, where and the U.S. loves to do this. They use the law as a way of waging economic, political war with other countries. They're using some of the principles that exist in international law as it relates what you mentioned about a national emergency and having the right to declare that. And then using all these mechanisms to then impose these sanctions in order to get a political result, in order to force governments to comply with their desires. I want to now maybe move to the issue a little bit more specific about some of the people on the ground that are actually suffering in Iran from this, because you are very detailed in your report about the examples you mentioned. You talk about that basically if I can say it in this simple way, that the people who are most affected by these unilateral sanctions, the ones that are suffering the most damage to their human rights, are the most vulnerable sectors of society. Low-income people, women-led households, Afghan refugees, those who are basically at the bottom of the social ladder. So if you could please give us a little bit more detail about the devastating impact this has on the lowest social level in Iran.
Unfortunately, when it comes to the point of the use of comprehensive sanctions, or pretty comprehensive sanctions, those who are the most vulnerable, they are affected the most. So the most clear reason for that as soon as sanctions are imposed against the main sectors of economy, and especially when it comes to the banking sector, the level of poverty is usually rising. So every country faces economic difficulties, inflation, people lose jobs, and the number of people being at the lowest income level is increasing. Level of poverty is also increasing. So naturally, those who already had very little money, they have even less. So they can't afford even the basic standards, for example, like three normal meals, or to buy basic medicine. For example, during the country visit to Iran, we have been reported about the cases when the poorest group of people were able to get the medicine at the very low cost with the subsidy of state, mm-hmm. and then they were trying to sell this medicine at the black market, much more expensive, in order to get money to feed their families. Correct. Because they have no other income.
They had to choose between medicine and food.
Indeed. Although they were able to get this medicine with the subsidies of a state.
Correct.
When it comes to other categories, so all those who were economically not stable, they are affected. Moreover, it also comes to the possibility to get, for example, health assistance. During the country visit to Iran, I have heard a lot that many people who used to use private medical services when they were having a stable income, after losing their jobs, can't afford it any longer. So the number of people who were using public medical facilities is increasing because these people have to start use public facilities.
Correct.
And plus because of the growing number of Afghanian refugees. All people have equal access to these medical facilities, but the number of facilities as well as the number of doctors stay the same or is growing very slowly due to the absence of money to build up new facilities, to provide the equipment, and to provide necessary doctors. Coming to the next issue, we come to the problems with delivering necessary medicine and medical equipment, and that means that for those who can effort going abroad and buying a medicine for him or herself, it won't be such a huge problem as for those who will stay in the country and are only dependent on the subsidies provided by a state. Same comes to the issue of refugees. Iran is hosting an enormous number of Afghanian refugees. It's already higher than 5 million people.
Correct.
And these people need shelter, need food, need medical assistance, need education. To be able to accommodate these basic needs, there shall be money for social protection, to build new schools, to build new hospitals, and to provide a shelter and provide some sort of food or provide some monetary support for these people. And in the face of shrinking revenues, a government can't do it because there are no money. Money shall be put for other elements. And as a result, those who are sick and they can't get medicine in the country, they are affected the most. If they can get medicine in the country, and I received numerous reports about the domestic production of medicine, mm-hmm. may still be affected because the raw materials for production of this medicine are also imported.
That's
and
correct.
That's also an issue.
Yes, so we had this issue with a COVID vaccine, just for our audience to clarify. We were producing the COVID vaccine, but the problem was that some of the raw materials for it was not allowed to be delivered. So we lost a lot of people in Iran, even though we ourselves were producing the vaccine. Please continue, Professor.
So those who are sick, those who are poor, or those who are vulnerable because of other elements will be affected the most.
Professor, we've come to the end, but just to reemphasize the issue of the Afghan refugees, because this is really a tragic situation that we have. You mentioned that the U.S. is already blocking, freezing the assets of the Afghan Central Bank, billions of dollars. We have this new wave coming to Iran. We have all these issues. So we're not simply talking about a theoretical political discussion here. When these sanctions are imposed, you have real effects on the ground. The most vulnerable people, I don't know if there is any more vulnerable group of people in the world like the Afghans, as we've seen over the last decades. And now we have a situation where Iran, which traditionally was actually quite good at taking care of the refugees in its own territory without any or very little international support, is now being prevented from taking care of these millions of Afghans, and, you know, God knows what will happen. So, Professor, thank you very much for joining us on Insight. We had a lot more to discuss. Unfortunately, our time is over. Hopefully, when the report comes out in September, we'll have another opportunity to have a discussion at that time. Thank you so much, and thank you for joining us on Insight.
Thank you very much.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Professor Duhan? The most important thing we came to understand is that the unilateral U.S. sanctions against Iran are a violation of international law and have a devastating effect on the human rights of Iranians and vulnerable groups such as the millions of Afghan refugees living in Iran. The decades of illegal U.S. sanctions against Iran have not achieved their intended goal of regime change or even a change of policy by Iran, and thus can be rightly called a dismal and abject failure, particularly the maximum pressure sanctions imposed during the Trump era. In the context of domestic U.S. politics, sanctions are a risk-free and sadistic tool for lazy and dishonest politicians to show their Zionist campaign donors that they are punishing Iran for its resistance to U.S. hegemony in West Asia, particularly its resistance against the racist apartheid Zionist regime that aims to ethnically cleanse Palestinians from their homeland. In the judgment of the independent UN Special Rapporteur, these unilateral coercive measures imposed by the U.S. are a violation of international law, particularly those related to the banking, insurance, and shipping sectors, as they make humanitarian exchanges, which are supposedly exempt from sanctions on paper, impossible as a practical matter. For those in the West and other areas of the world who claim belief and adherence to international law as a basic value, it's very significant that the independent UN Special Rapporteur has judged these unilateral sanctions to be violations of international law and the human rights of Iranians and the millions of refugees living in Iran. And this has now been recorded as a fact in the annals of history and international law. This will have very little effect on U.S. elites who always view themselves above the law of nations and exempt from the same rules and standards that apply to all other humans on the planet. But it will have a significant impact on certain hypocritical European elites who very broadly open their mouths about international law and universal human rights, but who blindly follow whatever the U.S. orders them to do in violating international law and human rights. For the Iranians suffering under these sadistic sanctions, the UN report might not have much effect on their daily lives, but it does signify an intermediate moral victory for them in their decades-old resistance against American imperial crimes in West Asia. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasir Rafi'i. Please stay tuned. Allah in the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Waqi'ah, states, This is indeed a noble Quran in a guarded book. No one touches it except the pure ones, gradually sent down from the Lord of all the worlds. What? Do you take lightly this discourse? These verses of Surah Al-Waqi'ah shows the importance of the content of Quran, to which we must not be neglectful.
مدهنون از دهن میاد. دهن یعنی روغن.
Now, the word mudhinun in verse 81 of this surah comes from the root duhn, which means oil. It means that we people take the Holy Quran lightly and are inattentive towards its content. In other words, the Quran invites people to concentrate more on the theme and content of this great book, since this is a book of guidance, and it includes various types of advice for the people. Thus, we must not be like oil towards the Quran, which metaphorically means that we must not be weak or act lightly towards it. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasir Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye. Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.